Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome back to Food Psych. This episode is a cross-post from my other podcast, Rethinking Wellness, that I think you'll really enjoy. It deals with themes of disordered eating and recovery from diet and wellness culture, and my guest has a lot of great insight to offer. Check out the show notes for their bio and all their links, and I can't wait to share the conversation with you in just a moment. Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I created to help you make peace with food, is now available as an evergreen, self-paced course with lifetime access. It teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict binge or restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up now for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common issues that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, special meditations, journal exercises, and more. Get all the details and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. If you like this podcast, I think you'll love my newest book, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. I co-authored it with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care, who are also multi-time fan favorite guests on this podcast. We joined forces to create a workbook for clinicians and general readers alike that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about what and when you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and wellness, and lots more. If any of that sounds interesting, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or click the link in the show notes. And now, without any further ado, here's the interview. Before we dive into talking about your work with kid feeding and all the specifics of that, I'm just curious to know how you came to do this work and sort of what your background is with diet and wellness culture personally as well.
Yes, I went to medical school and I certainly did not expect to be doing feeding work as a focus. I was in family medicine. And I, as a family doctor, was asked all the time about growth and nutrition and feeding and, you know, picky eating and all the usual. And I really had no training in it. But somehow I thought I was qualified to give advice. And so I think that that may resonate with your audience in that I think there are a lot of people out there, from the medical providers in the establishment to the wellness folks, who are giving feeding advice and really aren't qualified to do so. So I just want to put that right out there. I didn't really know what I didn't know. And that's hard looking back now that I may have been unhelpful as someone who wants to help. So anyway, I found my way to this work as a parent, as I think a lot of people do. I had an uncomplicated pregnancy and I had a child that was off the charts in terms of weight and length. And pretty quickly, I started to really worry that she was too big. This was at the time when, you know, the childhood, I don't like to even use the word here, but it's appropriate, the childhood obesity panic was sort of starting 19 or so years ago. And I had worked in college health with eating disorders, and I had seen in primary care how much struggling with a relationship with food in our bodies impacts health and wellness throughout the lifespan. So I had this child who was big and had this lovely appetite and enjoyed eating, and it scared me. And so I came to feeding her from a place of anxiety and prevention, and we got in the weeds really fast. I had this idea that I could prevent, you know, certain weight outcomes or health outcomes. And so I was feeding from this mind space, and I pretty quickly had a toddler who was food preoccupied and anxious and eating as quickly and seemingly out of control. And so my relationship with feeding her was really defined by anxiety and fear and trying to control things I couldn't control. So I got really lucky to bump into a pediatric dietitian at an airport, ironically, while my toddler was inhaling her child's snack. And I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I said, oh, I'm a pediatric dietitian. You should read this book, Child of Mine. And so I read Ellen Satter's book, and it within a few weeks had really, I felt much more reassured, what kind of understanding what I can and can't control. And very quickly, instituting that division of responsibility, things turned around within weeks. You know, she was saying no to food and playing where she was previously, like, you know, focused beeline on other kids' snacks. So it was just totally transformative in my own home. And so I had to learn more. I actually went and trained with Ellen Satter. I joined her clinical faculty. I took her courses. And, you know, you asked about my journey. I was raised in a very fat-phobic home. I had my weight-centric training. And seeing my daughter's capability, like, hold up, she can turn down ice cream because she's full. Not that that's the goal, but, you know, she could eat some ice cream and be like, I'm full, and we'd put it in the freezer for later. And then learning more from people like you and others online and doing so much more research and reading that I wasn't even exposed to in my training, I started to learn about, you know, internally driven guided eating, like intuitive eating and eating competence ideas. And so I'm just so grateful for this journey that, you know, I have a 19-year-old now who is really able to feed herself well and relates really well to food in her body. And the mind space that has been freed for me from my own eating and family and worries, I'm just forever grateful for this whole journey.
Thank you for sharing all that. And I really appreciate you acknowledging, like, your sort of areas of inexpertise as a medical provider, because I think so many doctors will give advice just based on what they know or what, you know, sort of diet culture stuff that they've absorbed, maybe without having a lot of training around feeding and eating and nutrition in general. And so it's just helpful to hear someone acknowledge that for sure.
Absolutely. And I just want to point out too that even some of the folks, you know, I do a lot of collaborating now with childhood feeding specialists, speech pathologists, occupational therapists, psychologists. And the sad thing is, even the pediatric feeding folks sometimes don't get a lot of training. So you might take your child to a feeding therapist, and then the reality is that they've had a 3-day course on a sensory program, and then they're doing feeding therapy. So it's really, really, I have so much empathy for parents, because it's really confusing when there is so much different advice and you think, well, this is a feeding therapist. And I, you know, I didn't know it either, but at the time, you know, SLPs and OTs, they don't necessarily learn this. It's not part of their curriculum, and there's not a licensing. And so you can do a 3-day training in one modality and then put your shingle out. So there are a lot of quote unquote experts that lack a really broad understanding of all the different things that can go into that piece of raising children to feel good about food in their bodies and with all the different scenarios and challenges or differences that can come up.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. And I'll share more later about my personal experience with feeding, but, you know, as a dietitian, just a, you know, general dietitian and now specialized in eating disorders, I didn't get training on pediatric feeding really at all either. And, you know, so feeding my own child, I've relied on resources like yours and Ellen Satter's and, you know, just sort of applications of what I've learned through intuitive eating, trying to apply that through the lens of responsive feeding, your work and Ellen Satter's work, to my own feeding relationship. You know, and still we've had some challenges, and we are just starting to seek out some help because our daughter has some medical issues that have been challenging and sort of intersecting in interesting ways with picky eating and selective eating at this age. She's 3.5. So, you know, it's kind of the height of the the picky eating time. And it has been really challenging to sort of find, like, who do I trust in this space? You know, who can I be sure is not going to lead us astray in this, you know, really authoritarian sort of direction around food, or getting overly involved in the child's food choices, when really I want to be able to trust her and, like, communicate that we trust her with food and have a more responsive feeding relationship. So it's just helpful to think through those things and think about, like, who has the credentials that I'm really looking for, who has the training in the background and can really help with these things, you know?
It's really tough. And I think, you know, parents know their kids best. Like my book and on our website, we have, like, here's a list of questions you can ask your therapist. And I think that's really helpful. But I think also, if, especially if you're in it, my kind of litmus test is if what you're doing or being asked to do increases your child's anxiety or yours, resistance, pushback, power struggles, for some, you know, gagging and vomiting. So sorry to bring that up. I suppose we should do just a warning. We might talk about some of those things. You know, trust that. And that if what you're being asked to do is increasing those power struggles and your child is getting dysregulated and having, you know, a 45 minute meltdown because of a therapy task at home, trust that and look for second opinion or other resources.
Yeah, that's hugely helpful. Thank you. Holiday shopping season is here, and the countdown is on for great gifts. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. Don't wait. The most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now is the perfect time to cross names off your list. I used Uncommon Goods to get something great for my daughter, who is so curious about what's inside our bodies right now. When I told her about intestines, it blew her mind, and she kept asking me to tell her about them again and again, which was so cute. And now that I'm pregnant, she's especially interested in all the different organs inside our bellies. So for Christmas, I got her a perfect gift. It's a stuffed toy called Little Patient, and it has an abdomen that zips open with plush organs inside that you can take out, which I know sounds kind of gross, but it's actually really cute, and I can't wait to give it to her. That one is unfortunately already sold out, but there's tons more cool stuff on Uncommon Goods for kids and for everyone you're shopping for this season. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/psych. That's uncommongoods.com/psych for 15% off. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. You know, I want to get into sort of some of the details and I guess the background really first about what a responsive feeding approach is, how your approach differs from some of the traditional models of feeding and eating that you might see with, you know, pediatric dietitians or speech language pathologists, and what the different outcomes might be.
Are we talking here where there might be feeding challenges or just in general?
I guess let's start with in general, you know, sort of a responsive feeding approach to generally feeding kids who maybe don't have anything else going on.
Absolutely. So responsive feeding is really, I mean, there are a couple different definitions and different ways of thinking about it. But to me, it's a focus on a warm, attuned relationship between the caregiver, the parent, and the child. We are feeding a child in ways that support their internal drives to eat, that intrinsic motivation. So it's an authoritative, you know, it's parents leading and then kids deciding. And we are grounding this, or a good way to think of it is in that division of responsibility, which I know you've talked about. So that's really foundational. And I've heard some say it's parents provide, child decides. But roughly the child is in charge of, you know, their own hunger and how much to eat from what is provided. And adults are providing enough food that tastes good or is accepted by the child, ideally offering variety, and then at regular intervals. So to me, the division of responsibility is really foundational. That's that core, is that the adults are providing that supportive environment so that even if there are challenges, it is responsive and we can help the child do their best and tune in to those hunger cues. I've moved towards the responsive language. I just love the word responsive. It to me really puts that dance between the parent and the child. I'm responding in the moment. I'm responding if my child has sensory differences. I'm responding where I might be offering extra snack. There's a little bit more flexibility than the division of responsibility model where I was trained in, where sort of a classic thing from DOR was like, oh, the kitchen's closed between meal and snack time. And that may work really well for a lot of families, but for other children and in other scenarios, we may need more flexibility. And so to me, that's one of kind of the foundational differences is having that flexibility both for the child and the parent. What is the parent able to do? How well are they supported or unsupported? What are their challenges? So it builds in a little bit more flexibility. It's a little squirrely because there's overlap and different ways of defining it, but we know that division of responsibility and responsive feeding are both endorsed by, you know, Academy of Pediatrics, World Health Organization, UNICEF endorses responsive feeding, for example. And I think one of the really important foundational pieces under all of this is trusting that pretty much across the board, we are born with the ability to regulate our intake. And children have these capabilities, and feeding them in this responsive way supports those ingrown capabilities. And there may be differences and challenges where we have to, again, be flexible or extra supportive. But, you know, even Melanie Loomer is this amazing psychologist who ran the pediatric feeding clinic in Calgary, and they treat 700 children a year with medically complex issues and all of these things. And she just said it's exceedingly, exceedingly rare to find a child who actually can't access hunger cues. So again, there may be maybe stumbling blocks or challenges, but generally we are born with these capabilities. And so responsive feeding supports that. So you ask, like, how is this different? Like, for example, when I took a sensory and behavioral-based feeding therapy program, they said things like, well, we have to teach children portion control, or kids don't like vegetables. So what I see over and over again in kind of the behavioral or therapy world is this assumption that, like, eating is really hard. And for most kids, it's not. There can be challenges. But, like, we have to micromanage. We have to teach. We have to do portion control. We have to control. And so I think that I see a lot of right now over-pathologizing and micromanaging and over-controlling with the best of intentions and often in really playful ways and with the smile. But I think we've gone down that sort of micromanaging and needing to take over from children where that can actually make things worse.
Yeah, that's a really helpful explanation. Thank you. And I want to dig into that, like, micromanaging approach, because I think it's so subtle and it's so common. And it's, I think a lot of people don't necessarily think of themselves as pressuring kids to eat or as interfering in their relationship with food in any way. It's like, I'm just trying to teach them to be healthy. I'm just trying to model good nutrition, or I'm, you know, just encouraging them to eat, but I'm not, you know, forcing them to stay and clean their plate the way my parents did. Right. So it can be on a real spectrum. But what does some of that pressure look like, or some of that sort of low-level restriction look like, and why doesn't it work to engage in those things?
So the low-level pressure and restriction, I like that you call it that. I sometimes call it, you know, there's negative pressure and restriction. And we're, most of us have realized you don't want to yell at your kid or scream at them or shame them, you know, which still unfortunately happens because it can be really scary if a child is, you know, having problems with growth or nutrition. So we kind of have moved away from you sit there and you eat it or I'm going to spank you, right? That you were saying what our parents did. And now it's this more sort of playful, and there's so many, like, TikTok and social media accounts, like, make it a game and who can crunch the fastest and who can eat this, eat this banana with three bites or whatever it is, or let's make art, you know, we're going to stamp with the blueberries, or, you know, let's do food science experiments or food play. I've had families of, you know, avoidant eaters where, like, the only, even the books that they're reading at bedtime, you know, the dinosaur eating the broccoli trees or the very hungry caterpillar, or whatever, the green eggs and ham. It's like even the time that's supposed to be about connection and winding down before bed has turned into this agenda of, you know, I need them to eat. And so even story time gets pulled into this anxiety. And so we even have research. There was a study that came out in 2023 that said games and playful stories, and they wrote unexpectedly increased avoidant eating. And I was like, not unexpected, you know, for me. I've seen this for decades where there's so much attention and it's so hard. And I had a parent write to me and say, you know, I hated sitting and eating with my child because no matter how fun I was trying to make it, I knew I was pressuring them to eat. And so part of me wants to just give permission to listeners to be like, yeah, this isn't working, the sticker chart or the rainbow, whatever. It's not helping my child to feel better. Our meals are not any more connected or calm. There's still tears. We're still wrestling over this stuff. Just permission that these tactics, these things we try to get kids to eat more, less, or different foods, even if they're playful or with a smile, they can backfire.
That really resonates with my experience, I think, because, you know, we were so hands-off with my daughter and just very relaxed, you know, division of responsibility, responsive feeding approach. Like, we would provide and give lots of variety and she would decide, and it wasn't a thing when she was young and eating really, you know, quote unquote, well, right? Like eating a lot of the foods and having a lot of variety and experimenting. And then as she started getting pickier, we started, you know, getting a little more nervous, I think. And then she developed a medical issue. And then it was like, okay, the pressure's on, you know, and it was this unintentional shift, but I think we all felt it. And I'm now reflecting on like how it has changed the feeding relationship. And, you know, it can be so subtle and it can be, you know, like engaging in those little games, like let's see who can crunch the loudest or whatever, right? And it doesn't seem like pressure on the surface, but actually it's making the meal about the food and how much the child is eating. And not just sort of focusing on keeping it relaxed and like letting them do their job with food and maybe having conversations about mostly about things other than the food, other than maybe to say, oh, look, this is really delicious, or would you like to try some of this, or whatever it might be.
It's very tricky and it's very subtle. And again, I'm grateful I came to this as a parent who was in that cycle of, you know, I'm trying this and it's not working and things are getting worse. And what it seems to do when you're in that cycle is prove that your child can't be trusted. For me, it was, oh, my child can't stop eating. You know, I have to control this. I have to clamp down. For kids on the opposite side of this eating continuum of like, you know, kids with avoidant or anxious eating where they may not be or might not seem to be eating enough or enough variety, the more we try to get them to eat, often the worse they do. And then it seems to be like, oh, see, they can't do it and I have to. And what I think is so damaging right now is with so much more attention to interoception, right? This idea of being able to feel what's going inside your body in terms of hunger, fullness, emotions, thirst, etc. Many children and parents are being told, well, your child has sensory differences, or your child is on the spectrum, or they have interoceptive differences, so they can't sense hunger. And that's terrifying, because if my child can't do it, I have to make them, or they'll die, right? This is really an existential anxiety. And then you really get stuck. And I've had kids where, you know, I tell this story all the time in training and in my book is, you know, a 4-year-old who has never initiated eating, never reached for food. And the parents were told, oh, they're underweight at birth, right? 10th, 15th percentile. So we can certainly talk about that whole issue too, is these misperceptions around growth at play. And they were told, you have to get them to eat. So right from the start, they were pushing and pushing food and pushing food. So a child who'd never asked for or initiated food and 2 years of feeding therapy, and they've been told they can't sense hunger. And when we actually looked and saw that, wow, 7 hours a day, they're either in the high chair or at the table, not a high chair, but you know, at the table, or being followed around with sips of supplements or crackers and earning stickers. And like the whole life of the family was around trying to get this child to eat. And I mean, really simple intervention of just let's limit eating time to 30 minutes every 2 to 4 hours, 2 to 3 hours, whatever. And, you know, no more following them around. We moved a bottle of milk to breakfast. I mean, really simple things that within 3 or 4 days, I got an email where the parent said, my child just said I'm hungry and asked for seconds on pancakes, which they had never done. So there are things, again, this is that point of like, how do we set up the environment around the child to support appetite? How do we trust that they have these capabilities? And like, did this child need 2 years of feeding therapy? I don't know, but they certainly were able to very quickly access hunger cues and begin to access those cues and show some capabilities. And again, I just feel for these parents, and I've had this scenario happening often enough that I just wanted to put that out there that I think we need to be really cautious before we say a child can't sense hunger. You know, how can we optimize the environment so they can do their best is, I think, a good way to focus things.
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. I want to explore the idea of weight a little bit more, because I think on all sides of the spectrum of weight, you know, there can be concerns that are maybe unwarranted, and there's like undue pressure placed on parents and kids and families to do something about their child's weight when the reality, I think, is much different. So can you talk about what that looks like to have both, you know, there's this child you gave the example of who's in like the 10th or 15th percentile being told they were underweight. And then, you know, kids at the higher end of the spectrum as well, like your daughter, maybe when she was younger, you know, the sort of pressure and the diet culture, weight stigma kind of expectations that come down on parents, I think, when they have a kid at the higher end of the weight spectrum as well. What does it do to focus on kids' weight like that to the feeding relationship?
It can absolutely destroy it. And again, as a doctor, I had zero training in how to interpret growth charts. And I think this is such an important point, because the worry about weight is one of the top three reasons why families get into dysfunctional feeding patterns. It 100% was for me, and I see this so, so often. And I think that it's such a shame, because I think parents and doctors don't understand how kids grow. And I did a lot of reading and looking into this and looking into growth charts. And when I was in training in my early years, and I'm in my mid-50s, I'm not that old, we did not check BMI for children. You know, you looked at the growth chart if there was something amiss. You know, I mean, you generally want to look at tracking. I'm not one of these people that says we shouldn't weigh children. I actually think that it's an important piece of information. But there is so much harm being done in misinterpreting that growth. So, for example, one of the diagnostic criteria for avoidant restrictive food intake disorder is faltering growth, or, you know, falling off the growth chart. I want to be really clear that any weight loss in any child is really needs to be investigated. But, you know, we have research in thousands of healthy children where they looked at their growth for the first year. More than a third of them will fall down lower onto lower curves in that first year. And a similar number will raise up on the growth curves. Only about one standard, like it looks like a bell curve, which is really, you know, people going, nah, you know, statistics class or biology, I'm having flashbacks. But humans grow in a wide range of shapes and sizes. And what's really, really tricky is in that first year, most kids are actually moving around on the growth curve. And yet I've had parents come to me and go like, well, my doctor said my child went from 23rd to 25th percentile, and now I need to switch to skim milk. It's like 23rd to 25th percentile is like, you know, nothing. It's not having a bowel movement that morning or whatever it is. And so there are a lot of misperceptions around growth. And, you know, you look at the growth charts, the first thing they do, they would hand me this thing, and it would, right at the top, it was like, your daughter is, and it would be bright red, 98th percentile, you know, obese. And like, here's these recommendations. I'm like, she's two. She's not drinking soda. We're not in front, you know, like it's sort of this boilerplate nonsense. And so there's actually a paper from, I think it was 2011, that looked at growth charts and said that mislabeling children as underweight can cause feeding disorders. You know, mislabeling these children is so toxic. And I'll get to the flip side in a minute, but We also have parents who may have these expectations. Like I had one family where the older child was 80th percentile, so a little more stocky. The younger child was 30th percentile and a little more lean. And the parents were like, I can see this child's ribs, like they're underweight. There was so much panic and anxiety because in their home, their reference point was a stockier child. They were both perfectly healthy, normal, thriving children. So we have these misperceptions. My child isn't eating enough. They're not big enough. And in that second case where the, you know, my child's underweight, they actually were not problematic. But then we see even just from that perception, parents getting into, you have to have two more bites of chicken. You have to eat your growing food first, you know, getting into pressure. So a super critical point. Children can be at the fifth percentile, which is labeled as underweight or failure to thrive, third, fifth percentile, and be totally healthy for them. I see referrals for underweight and parents are like, well, I'm 5'1 and my husband's 5'4, you know, and we were just small. So there are so many misperceptions where we're plotting a child. Oh, we're in the red or yellow or orange zone or whatever. And now we've turned the child's body into a problem to solve. We've raised the parent's anxiety and we've now introduced the anxiety and the idea that parents can and should control how much their children are eating so that they weigh more or less. And it just doesn't work that way. And I want to just real quickly say, in that paper that talked, and this was from the CDC, by the way, how dangerous it is to mislabel children as underweight. They did not say how dangerous it is to mislabel them as overweight or obese, quote unquote, on the growth charts. And that's weight bias at play. I think it's just as dangerous to mislabel children or to label them at all. I mean, there's so many hours of conversations we could have, but I just want to focus on this idea of labeling children. We know that the BMI is a screening test under age 6 is not even accurate 2/3 of the time to identify what the test says it's identifying, which is fatness, you know, percent body fat. So we're using a screening test that I wish would go away forever. And it's especially harmful on children. And we know that Black and Brown children, Indigenous children are harmed even more. They're mislabeled at even higher rates. So I just want to put out there that this quest for our medical providers to label an early intervention is causing so much harm. And we're missing opportunities to help children be healthier who happen to fall in the, quote, normal range. So anyway, there's my TED Talk on child BMI, but there's so much misperception on the role of caregivers, on the role of medical providers, that it's really doing a lot of harm.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I want to explore more how you can help parents get comfortable with this no pressure approach, especially when their kid is being labeled or mislabeled in many cases as, you know, having a problematic weight, right? So whether that's underweight or quote unquote overweight or, you know, quote unquote obese now, and, you know, there's now recommendations of putting kids on GLP-1s and things like that. It's a scary time, I think, for parents to be navigating all of this. And they feel so much pressure, I think, from providers, sometimes from family members. And it can feel really uncomfortable, right? And especially if a kid has, you know, medical issues as well, like whether it's, you know, diabetes or low blood sugar, or there's, you know, neurodivergence going on, like there can be a lot of things complicating it as well. So how do you help parents get their head around, get comfortable with this no pressure approach when, you know, they might be getting pressure themselves from so many other sources?
It is so, so hard.
You've been listening to a free preview of this episode. To hear the rest and get tons more great bonus content, upgrade to paid by going to rethinkingwellness.substack.com.